Well, bringing us home is the one guy who this PowerPoint I don't need to put up by myself. He can do it by himself. Douglas Colquhoun. Douglas, colleague of ours, anesthesiologist, intensivist, colleague at MPOG, will be talking about the opioid dashboard. Douglas.
I missed it in all that excitement. Okay, so my name is Douglas Colquhoun. I'm an anesthesiologist and critical care medicine physician at the University of Michigan. I'm a research fellow, and I work primarily with the MPOG group. I wanted to talk today about some working that our group has been doing widely, and this is very much as a group effort, to talk about measuring variability and measuring variability in opioid equivalence. And that was something that we kind of started to talk about last year. We went away and spent some time doing it this year, and it has some very interesting implications for our quality program and also for some of our research agenda. So we'll talk about exactly how the opioid equivalence program measures work in MPOG. We're going to talk a little bit about how we're going to start to think about measuring variability and less so about benchmarks, and that's just some implications for the quality folks in the room. And then we're also going to talk about some of the implications that this type of sophisticated analysis does have for research, but that'll be, I think that'll fairly naturally emerge from our conversation today. The development of the OME framework was heavily led by Mike Burns, so he deserves a lot of the credit for what we're presenting today, for what's being presented today. Also ably assisted by John Van Der Ves and Barong Shi, some of our developers back at MPOG. Mike's going to be presenting more about the details of how this is working tomorrow morning. So if you want to get to the Moscone Center at 7:30 in the morning, he'll be presenting. he'll be presenting there. It's room 20, in case you're wondering. Mike and I are both funded by a T32 grant, so we have to recognize NIGMS. So we're going to call this a tale of three hip replacements. So there's three cases. You look at the anesthetic records, and there's your three totals for your three different records. The first two, look relatively standard. The first person got a little fentanyl with induction, a little dilaudid at the end. Second patient, there's 5 mils in the fentanyl vial, so they just got all 5 mils. 50 mics every 30 minutes, the classic way. And then get some morphine at the end. And the third person got a spinal. So how do we try and assess kind of the opioid load that patient got exposed to? Because they're different routes, different places, different drugs, and different times during the case. So our first step is that we try and pick out the opioids and we pick out the routes. We run that through our equivalence table, which kind of tries to get in a sense of the route, the drug, and gives a conversion factor to it. And then it kind of creates this kind of OME number. So that's how we, in broad terms, comes up with an opioid equivalent numbers. When we go to actually think about doing some comparisons, we try and think about comparing cases that are about the same type with cases of about the same type, because we don't want to make general statements across our data set. We focus on high volume cases in our dashboard setup. We try and adjust it based on case length. We don't want to punish sites for whom their providers their typical case length is longer or shorter, and we standardize everything to at least a minimum of an hour. And then we also try and adjust for patient factors, and we try and standardize it as if it was a 70-kilogram patient, or like 0.7 of a standard Michigan patient. And that helps us generate this opioid equivalency dashboard, which I think some of you, if you're a QI champion for your organization, should have had exposure to at your institution. And that looks at these common case groups and gives you some sense of where you are compared to other sites. So that's kind of the big, quick, this is how this kind of all works out. If we think, however, a little bit more broadly about what that starts to tell us in our quality program, then that's a little bit different. They're talking about, this is taking us into a whole discussion about this consideration of variability rather than meeting or failing to meet benchmark targets. Our current measures, typical things that are around this idea of a 90% threshold. They allow 10% of cases that don't meet the standard. 10% of cases that maybe there's an error in documentation. Maybe they missed it by a minute or two, so it probably is not clinically significant. Tim Dubovoy talked a little bit about that. Talked about there's maybe 10% of cases, there's maybe the sum of that cases is cases where there's a rule, and this is appropriate to break the rule because that's the right thing to do for the patient. And so there's maybe these edge cases, these cases that we never really anticipated when we thought about it when we designed measures, or the quality committee designed measures. So if you look at our provider, then they get this kind of scorecard, and they met most of their cases. They didn't meet some of their cases. But we put our 90% threshold, and as far as we're concerned, this person is meeting threshold. So is that person, and that person. They're all the same, as far as we're concerned. They're all meeting threshold. So that gives us a question. We don't make any differentiations between them. It's probably not appropriate to make differentiations between them. But what can we do to drive our quality? Because all we've got is a lot of people that are meeting thresholds. And for a lot of our sites, particularly our Blue Cross Blue Shield funded sites in the state of Michigan, this is what a lot of their dashboards look like. They're doing really well. We're doing some really nice work, and we're actually performing consistently high quality, or performing consistently with high quality anesthetic care. And that's great. And there is a role to dive into the cases for which there's times in which you've failed, and we've explored that role, some of that today. But I think there's also a role to start talking about variability as well. And we talked about how we're doing pretty well. So the differences that we're starting to see of 1% or 2% between providers or between institutions probably aren't meaningful, and they certainly aren't meaningful in the context of without having very, very high numbers of case samples. And if you're statistically minded, that's the 95% confidence interval around a proportion of 0.9. It takes you out to 900 cases, and you still can't tell the difference probably between 87 and 92, even if you have incredibly high sample sizes. Which we don't. So that's where I think there's a case that we should be starting to focus our quality management energy into discussions around variability. So if you look at our opioid dashboard, we can get variability within institutions, and this is one particular institution, back up there, for which there's a 50% difference, give or take, 0.6 to 0.9, in their opioid equivalents for this particular case type. That's a big difference within a case, and these are actually decent sample sizes. If you also look between institutions, same idea here. We can get this idea for where there is a different, one institution is using twice as much opioids as another. And this is all about having conversations. And these forums that we've created here, and the relationships that you guys are building with each other as we have these discussions is really exciting, because it's about, hey, how do you do your cases like this? Because I want to understand how this sort of variation accrues. So lastly, we'll talk quickly about what the implications are for some of these types of work for MPOG's research. OME is not a perfect science. No, we're not going to pretend that it was. It was designed as a clinical concept around the idea of substituting one opioid for another, a game that we've all actually had to play clinically in the OR for the last 3 years. Give or take. It was actually designed mostly in palliative care and the concepts of switching between different types of opioids on patients nearing the end of their lives. It's about, there's some big questions about how route of administration comes into this play. These estimates are very inaccurate and they're very guesstimational, but it's a start. And it doesn't work well for drugs for which there's very long or very short half-lives. If you use a remifentanil infusion, you appear to give a phenomenal amount of opioid to a patient. If you use methadone routinely in the operating room, then you appear to use relatively less. And obviously, those are the extremes. And we try to adjust for that a little bit, and I suspect there's some more science that we can apply to that problem. But that doesn't mean there's no utility in this at all. And all of this, of course, is dependent on accurate documentation at times of source. But I think it's a way that we can start to think about applying and aggregating our data together. Because when we build from this type of analysis, we're using OMEs already in the EOS study, and that was presented fairly extensively today. But it's also indicative of that we, as a research community, are demanding very sophisticated ways of handling our data. Back in the original studies, we may even have, did you use this drug, yes or no? The more sophisticated version of that became how much of that particular drug you do. And now we're trying to quantify entire classes of drugs. And it's not just opioids, because coming down the line, there'll be things about vasopressors and local anesthetics, because that's what our research community is pushing us towards doing. The goal is to try and build these kind of summary measures that takes data and is able to make a useful number out of it and be able to do something that helps us understand our data set a little bit more. And that gives us a sense, maybe things like, what is the average MAC of our case? These are complex calculations that are being used, across the entire data set. It's about serving this community. So we've talked a little bit about this very specific use case in the context of opioids. We've talked about how that could actually change some of our conversations around quality. And we've actually talked as well about how in research, this is going to be the way forward as we start to build out this work. Thanks so much for your time.
We do have time for one or two questions.
Hi, Gurmukh Sahota, UPenn. I have a question about the opiates. So let's say I have a patient who comes in and is taking heroin off the street, is on oxys all the time, this, that, and the other. I can give them intense amounts of opiates and look like I'm doing a horrible job, but I haven't done anything as of yet, except for replace what they were taking from home.
And I think, and I hope what emerged from my talk was there was no value judgment associated with that. I have no concept of whether lots of opioids or no opioids are the right thing to do for particular patients at particular times. It's unlikely that the entirety of your patient population is the scenario you describe. In fact, within your institution...
I work at some inner city places, so sometimes...
But within your institution, that's also the entirety of your colleagues' experience as well. So maybe for your discussion, the discussion is within our institution, this is what the variation looks like. Maybe that's just, it's about trying to empower these discussions within institutions, and that's what we're hoping to be able to do.
So I would only add on to that just to say that I think it's important to kind of look at it in a bigger picture. Like, there were other things that you were saying, like other projects, and I think you have to kind of take into account what the substrata of the patient is before you try to look at just what you're trying to measure at them, like what the average MAC value is. If the patient has a history of head trauma, has had other sorts of surgery, these sorts of things are going to affect what my anesthetic will be, and I might be using intraoperative neuromonitoring as well to kind of manage that. That may not be recorded anywhere.
Yeah, so. Absolutely.
I really appreciated that you saw the funnel plot. The Bayesian statistician Spiegelhalter first showed that in a study of the New York Cardiac Database back in 2004. That is the more appropriate way to start looking at variability, not the caterpillar or leak plots, which you then next showed, which it just doesn't work well. So great, I hope MPOG and Aspire moves towards funnel plots in showing data.
Thank you.
I found the idea of variability intriguing. If we think about the heart rate variability of a baby during birth, a healthy baby has a lot of variability. Almost dead babies has always the same heart rate. Now, if we transfer that concept to the anesthesia provider performance, is that provider better that always gives the exact amount of whatever to the same kind of patient? Or is that provider better who seems to be giving a different dose for every patient he sees or she sees?
I think it's challenging, and I think one of the things that would be tragic to take away from this is to always give the entire vial of drug, which is fear is what some of us sometimes do, and in the management of our cases. And I agree, there is a tension between customizing your care for the bit in the best interests of your patients, but at the same time, a lot of us, I think, pretend that we customize our care, and we actually have no concept of whether we're doing well or doing badly. And there's a whole discussion about measuring relevant outcomes for our patients that we need to be interpreted in light of that customization. If we're customizing, are we going to customize it for good of the patient?
All right, Zulfikar Ahmed, Mount Pontiac, Michigan. Some of you might have read an article in New York Times some months ago where the New York Times journalist who was living in Germany underwent a robotic hysterectomy, and she was very concerned about her pain. And she addressed to the surgeon, "You're going to give me a good amount of narcotics?" And the surgeon says, "No, we don't." And then she talked to the anesthesiologist later, who also reassured her that we do not give any narcotics for any of these our patients for robotic hysterectomy. She was concerned, afraid, scared, but she did well with zero narcotics in the post-operative period. So I think here's the challenge. can we think of a model in our system where we say zero narcotics in the post-operative robotic hysterectomies?
It's a challenge. And it's about, but I think that what was key, and I read that article as well, was the thing that was interesting was it was about setting of expectations. Here's the deal. In order to feel better in the long term, you're going to have some short-term discomfort. But that's but I think the other theme about it was this discomfort also will give you some idea of whether this is an appropriate activity for your stage of recovery as well. So rather than the approach of blanket medication and trying to cause patients to have function. And I think the chronic pain physicians in the room will explain to us that opiates have never really been shown to improve patient function, even if we think it might do.